Hey, dear listener. Welcome to another episode of 10 Laws with East Forest. I'm East Forest, and today I'm really excited to bring you a conversation with Charles Eisenstein. Charles is someone that I go back pretty far with, actually. It goes back to 2008, and I don't know if I have him to thank or to blame for moving to Boulder, Utah, but I went to a little retreat, little conference out there at the Boulder Mountain Guest Ranch. And really the only reason I went is because there's the online magazine that was really kicking up back then, Reality Sandwich, that sort of spun off into Evolver. I don't know if you remember that. And I'd read a book by Daniel Pinchbeck. It was Breaking Open the Head. In the back of it, it had a little web address for a Reality Sandwich. And I was looking for more information back then. And I went to the site and I went on Reality Sandwich and they had an advertisement for this retreat they were going to put on in the fall. And the retreat was pretty much about like nature hiking, talks about consciousness, psychedelics, all sorts of counterculture subjects. And I'd never been to Utah, to be honest. Growing up in Oregon, I hadn't really thought about Utah. Like most people, I just thought about the Mormon thing and I wrote it off. But I called up Brandy, who was who's my friend now, who's still there. And I was sort of trying to like, has hemming and hawing about the price and whether I should come. And I remember her saying, you know, dude, you should just come. If you need to sell some photographs here in the office or whatever it is, I was a photographer at the time. You should just come. So I decided to pull the trigger. And that was because the three people talking were Daniel Pinchbeck, Dennis McKenna, and Charles Eisenstein. And I knew Dennis McKenna being Terrence McKenna's brother. And I was just getting into his work. And I just read The Ascent of Humanity, which was Charles's, I think his second book, but kind of like his first book. And it's a big old thick book. Probably, don't quote me on this, but 600 or 700 pages. I read the whole thing, and it basically shows you going all the way back to the Stone Age, how lighting, in essence, the first fire in the Stone Age that separated us from the night. It was like lighting a fuse in a way that was this inevitable path that he was calling the ascent of humanity, moving into an age he was calling the age of reunion. And of course, pre-2012, we're all really excited about where that can go, but it's still something we see happening, and it's still a faith and a truth that he holds on to, and it's really important. And when I got to meet him down there, I remember we were in the dining room, and I met him. I was nervous, and as I got to know him over the next few days, just hanging out in these little talks and going on hikes, he was someone that struck me that really walks his talk. And that was the most inspiring thing beyond anything that I read. And it moved me in such a way that it made me believe that a new story was possible, that a more beautiful world that our hearts tell us is possible, as he would put it, is possible. And that was just by the way he carried himself and seeing that his path and himself as a seeker was manifest in how he approached his life, not just his words and his work. And I have good memories of that retreat and Charles at it. I mean, I remember he was really excited to be in a place of wilderness and he slept out on the deck. I remember at least one of those nights under a big pile of blankets and it was cold, but he just wanted to be outside. And I remember going on a hike and he came back from a hike with the group and his whole face was covered in mud. And he said it was like a better form of sunscreen or something like that. And just a good time. I just loved his ability to dive in head first and to really be true and honest about just exploring that his own sense of truth. It was really wonderful. And that ranch is the same place that I do my retreats now, because the retreats that they were doing there, they happened for 3 or 4 years, but then they stopped. And I always missed them. And so I kind of wanted to pick up that mantle of having a place to meet other folks and dig into these alternative ideas and be inspired by nature and just be inspired by place and time. So that's why we're doing the East Forest Retreat, and we do it at the same place. And now I live there. So you can see this whole thing with Charles, it's kind of like going back to a weird starting point. It was my own ascent. Oh, okay, that was a bad joke. Anyway, so we stayed in touch, and a few years later, I helped him when he was working on a speaking tour for a later book, Sacred Economics. I guess he would say it wasn't a book tour. I guess it wasn't, but it was an event where he spoke, and I was willing to help him put on the Portland version when I was living in Portland. And so I led that charge with some other people there, Kent Bye and a bunch of Evolver people. We had a bunch of volunteers, and we put him in First Presbyterian Church, which is a really lovely, large premier space for independent thought and speakers. And it was just a gangbusters event. It had more people than we could hold, and I just remember feeling so overflowing since then. So we've crossed paths a few times since then, and he's someone that I consider a friend, even though I don't get to see him too often. But it's always a pleasure when we do get to talk, we do get to connect, and I always find it inspiring. Recently, I saw him on Oprah, which a few months back, which I thought was pretty cool that, you know, his work is, I think the book for that was The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Tell Us Is Possible, I believe. Sorry if I'm wrong on that. I read that too. And it was great seeing him sitting in one of her big, big old armchairs and have her be super excited about a phrase and repeat it back and say, I love that. So we get into that and a bunch of other subjects, and I'm really excited to have him on board. So thank you to Charles Eisenstein. I'm just getting back from Portland. I was super happy to have that run to do everything with the AWOL Dance Company. Man, what a joy. I really wish we could take that show on the road or do it elsewhere. It's not every day that a whole dance company reaches out and does an entire show around an album of yours. And I was just full of gratitude and big smiles looking up as we're performing outside and seeing all this amazing choreography and the lights and everything they did. And it's just, collaboration is so beautiful. Like, you know, it's a good reminder that we can in some ways only grow larger than ourselves when we bring on other people. And the greatness that we strive to and the greatness that we can be can only be when we start to work together in groups, and even in larger ways in communities and societies. So I was seeing that manifest right in front of me, which was a lovely thing. A lovely thing. If you like this podcast, please do give it a review. You can scroll down in some way or another on your phone there and hit 5 stars. And all those little comments are very, very helpful in the rankings and getting other people to pull the trigger to give it a chance and give it a listen. And of course, you can always share it. So please do that. And write me with any questions or tell me what your own 10 laws are at info@eastforest.org. I have a lot of events coming up. Check it out. But we'll just get into this conversation now. This is my friend Charles Eisenstein on 10 Laws. Thank you so much for joining me. It's like been a long time, and it's always good to see you and talk to you.
Yeah, it's been like 5 years maybe since Portland, right?
Probably. I was actually just in Portland like a few weeks ago, and I drove by. I was on my bike, and I went by the church that you were at, and it brought back a lot of memories. So it was sort of fitting. I was remembering like it was overflowing.
Yeah.
When you were in that chapel, and I wanted to have them put you in the big church, and they were like, well, maybe. And then like we did the event, and there literally were people in the aisles and at the doors.
Yeah, there were like 500 people at that event.
Easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I think I saw you at Beloved briefly or something like that. And then you came back to Portland for, I don't remember what you were there for. You did a little talk, did a little music with you for some group.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking to do a little bit of that kind of stuff in the next, you know, half year around the launch of my new book and stuff. I haven't really.
I got an email about your book this morning.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's a good place to start. I have all sorts of like larger questions we could get into, but I would like to make sure you tell me a little bit about what it is you're working on right now and what's coming out, when it comes out, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really, don't feel like you have to like help me promote anything, but it has been on my mind a lot.
Yeah.
Because I spent 2.5 years writing this book, and now, like in the past, I had this habit of, okay, I finished writing the book, you know, moving on. Uh-huh. And I never really stood behind the work and did anything like promotion. You know, I mean, I would go and speak and stuff, and I would often speak about the books, the topics in the books, but I always would move on, I think, maybe a little too quickly. And so I think some of my earlier books never reached their full natural audience. So this time I'm deliberately organizing some events where I'll speak about the book.
And sell it. I remember you came to my event when we did the event in Portland, you weren't going to bring books. And I was like, you definitely need to bring some books. And so I think you shipped some at the last minute and they sold. It's like, you know, we want to spread the good word.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, the book is about climate change, mm-hmm. which is like a big turnoff to people. Once I got a letter from an email from somebody saying, I really loved your article that you just put up, but I almost didn't read it because it had climate change in the title. And I thought that I must already know what you're going to say.
Uh-huh.
So I just want to assure you that I'm not saying anything that you've heard before.
Well, yeah. From what I've gleaned from your new book and some of the essays you've put out there about the subject, it's somewhat in line with some of your other thinking about transcending an us versus them mentality. Am I somewhat right? Not to summarize the entire book, but as far as the thought that it's maybe a slightly different approach.
Well, that is related because the point that I'm making a lot about an us versus them mentality is that those polarized conversations leave untouched what is usually the most important issue, which is what both sides unconsciously agree on, but don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So the climate debate is very highly polarized. I've looked into both sides. I mean, it's actually kind of more than two sides, but for simplicity's sake, I'll say that the one side says global warming is a severe threat to humanity. It's going to cause terrible consequences. We may not be able to handle those consequences. It could end up even in the extinction of the human species. We've got to do something fast. And the other side says global warming isn't happening, or if it is happening, it's because of natural causes, or even if it is happening, it's not a bad thing. Might postpone the next ice age, et cetera, et cetera. So those are essentially, the whole conversation is about global warming. And one thing that I confirmed in my research and in my thinking about it is that the real crisis transcends warming or cooling. Like, whether or not global warming is happening, there is a severe ecological crisis that is mm-hmm. deranging the mm-hmm. climate.
Right.
So, right. You know, this summer we had record hot temperatures in many places in the Northern Hemisphere. And at the same time, we had record cold temperatures in many places in the Southern Hemisphere. We had severe droughts, even like flash droughts, forest fires, floods, like all kinds of stuff. And if you average all that out, you might get, I don't know, I mean, who knows? You know, average it all out, and maybe it turns out that it wasn't a very warm year after all. But when you average things out, you obliterate a lot of information.
Yeah.
So what if the future is not warming, but increasing derangement of the climate system. Just like if you're, if you damage your organs, eventually you're going to be unable to regulate your body temperature, unable to regulate all of your other physiological processes. So I ask then so I use that metaphor, and it's more than a metaphor, to see Earth as a living being. And in fact, yes. I think that the initiation that climate change is providing us is an initiation into seeing Earth as a living being, seeing ourselves no longer as its masters, and seeing Earth no longer as a source of resources and a big garbage dump to use any way we want, without regard to its own, the feelings, the desires, the well-being, the health of the Earth. So I'm probably going on too long, but I'll just finish by saying that that seeing Earth as a living being, then we start to ask, well, what are its organs that we are damaging? Right. And it's the forests, it's the wetlands, it's the soil, it's the megafauna, the whales, the elephants, the predators, the fish, the seagrass meadows, the mangrove swamps. All of these things are the organs and tissues of a living being. And even if we cut emissions to zero, if we keep destroying the organs of Gaia, then the world will still die.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if I destroy your organs, but I keep you in a perfectly climate-controlled environment that maintains your body temperature exactly at normal, you're still going to die.
Mm.
So this is, yeah, that's so a big theme of the book is what I just talked about.
So it seems sort of like you're saying, like, no matter what position you take in the argument of climate change, it's sort of undeniable that there is volatility and things happening in the environment right now. I mean, just right now, I'm in Boise, Idaho right now. Mm-hmm. I'm at my lady Rada's house, and I can barely see because of the smoke. And I drove here yesterday from Portland. The entire way was the same thing. And the fires are, from what I'm hearing, you know, it's either coming down from Canada or coming up from Southern Oregon or Northern California. The same thing last summer. Whether I was in Salt Lake City, Boise, Portland, it seemed like wherever I went, at times there were moments I couldn't see more than a few hundred feet. And this is because of, and that was not the case. I grew up out in these areas. That did not happen when I was a kid. It would be very, very rare. And this is really normal now as far as summer forest fires. And so, I mean, that's just like, look, it's right there. You can't deny that this is different. And one thing I've always thought about is like, you know, we are the Earth manifest, literally. Like we're sort of like walking, talking, thinking, breathing. We are it. We come from its constituent parts. And we are, it's sort of an apex form of it, being able to have humor and creativity and all the epic things we do. And it goes back to sort of your central argument that I read about way back in your second book, Ascent of Humanity, about just basic separateness, this feeling of separateness and how that's engendered in us and all the sea of problems that come out of that, that really the suffering that comes out of it for ourselves and the consequences for things like the planet and our communities and everything else.
Yeah, right. And one of the fundamental forms of separation is seeing ourselves as separate from Earth. Not only, and there's two forms of that separation. One is just to, you know, see ourselves as not part of nature and what happens to the world need not affect us. That's one kind of separation. And another kind of separation is to say that we are existentially different than all other matter.
Right.
That the qualities of a soul or of a full, complete self only are in human beings. And everything else is just either genetically programmed meat machines or dead inanimate matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the only beings here. And so that's a subtler, but actually even more poisonous form of separation.
Oh, I think that's almost probably at the core of the separation of like Western thinking and the mainstream thought. You know, kind of, you said it sort of started back with Newton and, well, I guess you could say it started with the first fire of the Stone Age, but
yeah,
I mean, did that whole sort of, I think, therefore I am, and the the religion of science, which right. It's not to, like, you know, again, make that a us versus them science or no science. I mean, there's a great line in The Simpsons where they want to burn down the library and someone says, what about science? And the crowd shouts, what good has science done for us lately? Let's burn it down.
Yeah.
And it's like, but there is, it's, I talk a lot about, or I think a lot about social media and its role in polarization and our thinking and our reality tunnels. And I had mm-hmm. to pull out of it a bit in the last year where I actually have an intermediary that posts for me because engaging with it, I had difficulty not having that kind of bring me down in certain ways. And I've talked to a lot of really smart people about the role of technology and how it sort of shapes our worldview and all the smart people that are working to help make it addictive and what it's doing to our minds and children's minds and as a culture. And these are things that, you know, you look at the whole pie of everything that's going on. And I think that's why I've always had such an interest in wilderness and nature and why I probably make field recordings and bring it into my music, because something tells me that there's something really important about, like, that which is still wild on the planet. And mm-hmm. something about those spaces connect into something in us that we've lost or is very quiet inside us. And when you're in that space, it awakens it in you in such a natural way that I find it very healing for myself. And something tells me that we can't lose that completely on this earth or we're in trouble. You know, I live where, you remember where we met at the retreat in Boulder? So I moved there. And so I live now inside the Grand Staircase National Monument, which is just shrunk by Trump. And I'm right there. And they're shrinking it so that they can mine uranium and coal in one of the most beautiful and ancient places on the planet. And it's unthinkable short-term thinking, but it's happening. And
yeah. So I think, like, you're talking about the shrinking of wild spaces and of wildness, and you said something like about the consequences of that. What did you say the consequences of that would be?
We start to lose that in ourselves because that is the reflection of us. And we forget what that wilderness is in our own hearts. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like we get so wrapped up in the devices and this sort of world that seems to exacerbate that sense of separateness. And it also starts to push that whole idea of, like, I don't know, authority over nature and control. And
So I think this is what we have to recognize, what you just said, that the consequences of the destruction of wildness and the paving over of the world and the replacement of it with electronic devices, because a lot of what's happening is the electronic devices are replacing things that we once sourced from community and from nature. It's not really giving us anything new in the world. So to recognize, as you said, the inner wildness dying, the consequences could very well be that humanity survives and the world dies. And that corresponding to the world, and it's been happening. So humanity is surviving just fine, 8 billion of us, and we're in the midst of a great extinction that's been going on for 10,000 years, ever since the megafauna started to die off everywhere human beings went to. So this is, and accelerating in the last few decades. So this is not science fiction. It's actually happening step by step, that humanity is surviving and growing even, and that the rest of the world is dying. So there's kind of the collapsist narrative that says this cannot go on forever. Eventually, we will die too if we kill enough of life. And I think that maybe, but what's the alternative if we don't stop killing the rest of life? The alternative is almost worse. Can you imagine a world where there is no more nature, where there is no more wildness, where you can't hear the birds' songs and the hum of the insects or see whales? Something then dies in ourselves, corresponding to what's dead in the world. And I think that this is already happening just through people's cutoff from nature. There's a hunger for the lost relationships that keep a person whole. Like, we need to hear those songs. We need to see those other beings. And if we're not enmeshed in rich, intimate relationships with the rest of life, we experience an inner poverty that is so painful that it unstoppably compels us to seek out something to feed that hunger. So we become addicted to substances, addicted to consumption, addicted to electronic devices, like anything to feel okay for a minute, you know, to push away that hunger, that longing, that pain that cannot be met. So I think the consequence of the ongoing destruction of the wild, and also the ongoing separation of ourselves from the wild into digital boxes, indoor boxes, will be a growing tendency toward addiction, a growing epidemic of depression and anxiety, like all the things that we're already seeing, opioid addiction, for example, pharmaceutical medications for depression and so forth. Like, these are symptoms of the killing of the world and of the killing of part of ourselves. So to me, that, and this is another part of my book, that our motive for environmentalism shouldn't be to save ourselves, to survive. That
right. Like, it's the same thinking, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be love.
Mm-hmm.
Love for the world that we're killing. That's the only thing that will reverse it. Not, we won't survive without it.
So in that thinking, maybe you talk about this in your book, have you come up with any practices or sort of approaches? Because, I mean, I think there's much disagreement for people we're speaking to about the enormity of the problem and the suffering. I mean, I think the biggest issues people face are faith and doubt and finding a path for themselves as an individual that feels like it has meaning, purpose, and effectiveness. Like, in some ways, like the problem itself as a mental construct is binary, and like the way above it is non-binary. Like, that love is almost non-dual in a sense. And so there is a sense of a paradox of just trying to hold the truth of what's happening and the truth of what it means to be incarnate right now on this planet, mm-hmm. and how to walk a life that's simultaneously enmeshed in it with our phones and our lives, but also wanting to walk in some kind of truth. And that's almost, it's like, that is the mystery in itself manifest. And so I'm wondering if you had any advice, or you've found things that work for you, or any recommendations besides changing our light bulbs.
Yeah. So the specific actions that each person takes are unique to that person.
Mm.
The more important question is, where do those new choices come from? They don't come necessarily from receiving more information or more accurate information about the state of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not ready to make a choice to step into deeper service, then you'll just ignore that information, or you'll deny it, or you'll put it in some out-of-the-way category and just not deal with it. So it's not information that we need more of, but it is an awareness of a choice that's being presented to us, coming from the inquiry, who am I and why am I here? That brings attention to the choice that we face, which is the choice to take a new step in offering ourselves in service to the potentiality of this planet. To, I call it, the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible.
Yeah.
And we can all sense that I think that the world that's presented to us as normal doesn't have to be this way. It can be better. Despite what our experience has told us, just that the world is getting worse and worse, we have a knowing that it doesn't have to be that way. A more beautiful world is possible. And from that knowing comes a choice. Shall I serve this possibility? This is not a choice that I can make for you or for anybody. It's a real choice. But I can bring attention to the existence of that choice.
Yes, and if they want to serve that, I mean, you know, they have that desire and it's coming from a place of love. I mean, what are ways, is it mostly about, is it emanating from that most basic place of your choices, your thoughts?
So once you make that choice, then the opportunities to act from that choice will present themselves.
Uh-huh.
And they may not fit into conventional climate narratives.
Uh-huh.
Because the way that we identify the problem is way too narrow. You know, the cause of ecological destruction is the same as the cause of social oppression, of political oppression. They all come from the same place.
Yes.
So what we need is, in every opportunity that is presented to us, to act more from peace, more from love, more from empathy, more from compassion and kindness. And the choice is to step into a new level of doing that, not to necessarily become an enlightened Buddha in this instant, but the understanding that there is a next unfolding that is presenting itself to us, and the feeling like, yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to up my game. I'm ready to make an offering of myself and a sacrifice of something that I've been holding on to. The sacrifice maybe of feeling all vindicated and right and good because I'm on team good, fighting team evil in this debate. Like, that could be a sacrifice, or a sacrifice of self-importance. There's always a sacrifice that is necessary to cross the threshold into a higher level of service. And the sacrifice is something that you will feel ready to make, even though it's a little hard to let go of it.
It's fairly nuanced, and also at the core of a lot of people's sense of being. Like, it might actually be almost hidden right in front of them.
Yeah, in plain sight.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually a subtler layer of personal development.
Yeah.
It's not something that probably someone else would also be able to tell you more than likely.
Right. And it could be helpful also, though, to say that because this service doesn't look like what we've been told is helping the problem, you might need some community and some encouragement to recognize it and to do it despite the doubts, despite the criticisms, because a lot of the things that are needed the most right now are pretty much invisible, not only to the system of economic rewards, but even to the system of social rewards that surrounds good work.
Yeah, say more about that. This is really important.
So if you're a traditional activist protesting police violence against Black people, say, you're going to get some validation from the movement that you are doing a good and important thing. If you say write a book that reaches hundreds of thousands of people, then the theory of change that immerses us says that you're having a big effect on the world. But what if you are spending your entire 20s and 30s or 40s taking care of your autistic son who needs your full attention just so that he can cope in the world? What if you're spending decades
these yeah, like the unseen The unseen, the uncelebrated, the unliked. Yeah.
Yeah.
The like, unquantifiable.
What if you're spending time with your mother, you know, who's who's elderly and needs you there? Like it's the person, like, you know, there'll be like the person out doing big important things, the person developing her career, and then there's the one in the family who's doing, who's changing the bedpans, who's doing the shopping for the elderly person, who's taking care of the kids. You know, like those kind of roles, it's hard to say how those are doing anything for the planet. But on some level, we recognize that that work is equally important. That work spreads a vibration or a morphic field of love. And we recognize on some level that a planet where we do not care for the most vulnerable people will also be a planet where we do not care for the most vulnerable beings, the trees that are being cut down. It's the same mentality that discards people, that also discards wetlands. It's the same mentality that exploits people and tries to extract the most possible from them, that does the same to nature. So this is, so to heal on this level is indispensable. If we do not heal on this level, then the ecological destruction will just shift from place to place to place, morphing into new forms every year as we put out one fire.
Yeah.
The next one rises somewhere else. It's like trying to solve the forest fires by developing better firefighting techniques. Like, well, we have to ask.
It's sort of a fire breeds fire mentality.
So yeah, just to validate the like what love calls you to do may not be prominent, may not be fancy, may not ever earn you applause from your in-group, may not make you feel like you're a change warrior. That might be what you need to sacrifice. But on a psychic level, yes, that is what holds the world together.
Yes. And I can see why that would be incendiary sometimes to say. For instance, going back to the Grand Staircase National Monument, someone might say, well, look, hey, there are the trucks coming in, building the new roads, and they're about to put the drills down, and we're going to try to teach them how to love. It won't work. They're going to drill. Like, I need to do action. I need to try to stop this instance. And for them, there's a disconnect about it's sort of the activist mindset, which the other side of that is just like total antipathy, where it's like you just feel like I can't. There's this, and then there's that fire, and this fire, and that fire, and the homeless person I step over 20 times a day. The enormity of it.
Right. I'm not saying that we should never fight something. Yeah. I just want to validate other forms of action.
Yes.
In the world. It could be that what your heart calls you to is to lay your body down in front of the bulldozers to stop the drills.
Mm-hmm.
And we also must recognize the limitations of the tactic of fighting something.
Mm-hmm.
If you're facing a stronger opponent, fighting probably will not win in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to recognize that we are facing a stronger opponent. We're facing the military-industrial complex. We're facing the police state. We're facing the surveillance state.
Right.
We're facing the financial system.
Yeah.
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 Like, yeah. So something, the path to victory cannot be to overcome them with superior force.
Mm-hmm.
The path to victory involves a change of heart.
What do you see as victory? I mean,
Humanity embarking on a course of healing and of service to life on Earth.
And when your first book, you talked about that whole ascent that we're on. It's the only path we could take to go where we're going. In a way, like, this is just as divine as anything else. And like, there was no other way for us to reach some age of reunion or a time of integrated healing or society of love.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I do feel that the entire horrible and beautiful course of civilization was inevitable and is happening for a reason, and was even willed into being through the intention of Gaia, that this is how a planet grows. This is part of the life cycle of a planet.
Us being the planet too.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of if you look at it that way, then it makes a lot more sense. You know what I mean?
Right.
How could it be more beautiful and epic than to have this great experiment of human civilization from the individual up to whole societies?
Right.
Figuring it out.
Right. So the mistake would be to think that this is the pinnacle of human development.
Yeah.
And to extrapolate our current form of development into the future. Because if you do that, you get to the concrete world that I was talking about before.
WALL-E, the movie WALL-E. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what our society is essentially trying to do, is to maintain the current mode and direction of development, to push it even farther, to hold on to a conception of progress that is no longer relevant. So there is facing us right now an opportunity to let go of that conception of human development, of progress, and to ask, what do we really want? Why are we here? It's the same question as the individual can ask, and we need to have ways to ask it collectively. Why are we here, and what do we serve? The urgency of those questions grows as the conditions under which we live become more and more intolerable.
Mm-hmm. Which is a lot of how a lot of change happens for people.
Through trauma,
intolerable circumstances, near death, divorce, bankruptcy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's to foster an awareness of a choice and to create the conditions for that choice. And not to, you might be able to stop one project by laying your bodies on the line. And that can be done in peace and in love, and not in, I'm going to show the public how terrible these people are.
Yeah.
And not in the self-righteousness of demonstrating just how sacrificing we are for good.
Man, that is a high road, right? Because everything is telling you the opposite. You know, every force is pushing you to, that you're going to be told by the mainstream that that's ineffectual and pansy. You know, it's like, it doesn't have that sort of patriarchal energy of like fighting. And
it's the opposite.
Of course. It's a difficult.
It's not ineffectual. It's not ineffectual. It's the opposite.
Well, I agree. I mean, you could look at how it's manifested in Trump, and how it's like, that's the ultimate sort of mirror or court jester, the ultimate mirror to everything that's sort of happening with our own energy of like fighting fire with fire. It just never ends. And then we're all mesmerized by the fire and you can't take your eyes off it, and the train wreck and pointing a finger. Right. But it's like, but we're all part of this show. And, it is a high path to recognize, you know, what I do believe that everything comes from the inside out, like the individual, that sense of that change and that love we want to manifest in the world. There's no other way for it to manifest, but that individual's just making that choice and moment to moment and riding those waves. I think telling that new story is perhaps the way that it feels like it has an effect, the way that you're bringing it beyond just your internal process of like, yes, I can make these choices in my life, that whether or not they're recognized, I feel that they have importance. I feel that it has meaning. I feel that this really matters. And then beyond that, I think people do want to, not everyone, but some people feel that they want to have an impact on positivity on some kind of change in the mm-hmm. world. And yeah. I think that's a really important thing to talk
that's
about.
That's something that you have infinite opportunities to do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anywhere you are, you can always transmit love. The story that you're talking about, a new story or a story of reunion or interbeing, that is the, I guess, intellectual dimension of something that's much bigger than a story that draws from a vibration that the world needs, a medicine that the world needs. And you, and so your role may not be to articulate that story with words. It may be to transmit the vibration through music or through acts of service or through kindness, generosity. Like there's so many ways when we stand in that emerging vibration of peace and love. I mean, I'm sounding like a hippie here, but you know, I mean, this is the truth. When we stand in that, then everything we do will be infused with that, whether it's our words or our music or our relationships. And that's the choice that I want to bring attention to. The choice to take the next step even more deeply into being a transmitter of the new story and all that it represents, the whole vibratory complex from which it emanates.
What role do you think forgiveness plays in that?
Forgiveness comes from seeing a truth that you had not seen before about the person that you had been blaming. It's not, like, forgiveness is a byproduct of something else. So when people say, well, don't ask me to forgive them, you know, especially if, like, you white person, don't ask me, a Native American person, to forgive the colonists and settlers for the genocide. Or, you know, you could apply it to many issues, right? They're actually, it's true, because you cannot ask somebody to forgive. It's not, forgiveness does not happen through an effort of will. Fake forgiveness comes through an effort of will, but not real forgiveness. Forgiveness is a side effect of seeing a truth about the circumstances of another person.
Or yourself, and, right? I mean,
or yourself, yeah.
An emergence.
And it comes from understanding, like, oh, now I understand why you did that.
So is it from empathy? You know, is it from felt experience?
Empathy is the precondition for it. Because to understand, well, usually it is, to understand why somebody did something, you have to even ask the question to begin with. And you have to ask it seriously. Not, how could you? Why did you do that? But really, like, why did you do that? What was your situation? What were you thinking? What were you feeling? Where were you hurting? From what place did you do that? And if you understand, you know, so empathy motivates the question that eventually leads to forgiveness.
But it seems like it plays a somewhat important role in this process of acting from peace and love. I mean, you could argue that some people who are acting very unconsciously, I've always thought that a level of self-forgiveness is there because there's a level of self-mutilation or self-hatred in creating more suffering for yourself. Maybe when you don't even recognize how you're doing that, you know, creating more anger and separation in your life. I often say that, you know, the only game in town is sort of wanting to return to God. It's like this sense of separateness we have. But we might not even, most of us don't even know that, but we might be doing it through Monday night football and beer or different ways we find to ease the pain. Or you could say that death, you know, the fact that it's the one thing we know, that we have this boundary condition to our life. We know we're going to die. And there's this like inability to accept that and all these choices and actions we make that actually stem from that when we don't even see it. And it's like there's these larger like actors at play, you know, there's these larger motivations, some of them unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important because I think some people look at some people and they think like, oh, they're just never going to wake up. You know, they're never, as they would put it, they're never going to see it. They're so far gone, or they're so far damaged, or how they grew up, or
It seems that way, doesn't it? Sometimes.
Well, look, I'm just making conversation. It's just, are you an optimist? I mean, you've really looked down the belly of the beast as far as with some of your research, and I know it's heavy.
Yeah, I mean.
And you've also gone out there and been at the spear tip of people and organizations that are really wrestling with this stuff.
Yeah. It is completely irrational, implausible to think that the world could heal. Looking at how bad things are and how it's accelerating, intensifying, an issue after issue after issue, there's really no good cause for hope. And at the same time, I know in my bones that it's not impossible for this planet to heal. Sometimes people are on their deathbed from cancer and their organs are shutting down and something happens and they heal totally inexplicably. They have a spontaneous remission. There's no mechanistic explanation for how that happens. You can't make that happen. It's really mysterious how that happens, why that happens, but it happens. If that could happen to a human being, it can happen to the world too. So it would be actually irrational to be hopeless. To be hopeless, you have to cast out those data points. You have to cast out every miracle that ever happened in your life. Yeah. Anything that ever happened in your life that was inexplainable, that you couldn't have made happen.
Or just everything beautiful, right? I mean, the fact that there's even beauty. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we're able to connect to that reality, then we will not feel despair. And I guess you could call that optimism.
Well, that's almost a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's sort of like working with your thoughts and recognizing those that you feel are distorted or irrational, not based in actual reality or truth. I mean, we can spin away with ourselves. It happens on an individual level in our minds, and it happens in the news and with ideas and memes. They're not even real or true, or they're exaggerated, or it's just sort of like the cliff notes. Even just the easy of just saying, here's another strike against the other team, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, we could do this forever. We could do this forever. What role then do you find that when you speak about all the miracles, I love miracles, that synchronicity plays as a way of this morphic field, this way of yourself, this way of reality sort of speaking to you and maybe playing with you? What role does it play for you, or what role do you feel it does play, if any?
Synchronicity is an outbreak of a deeper intelligence that governs the world.
I love that. An outbreak of a deeper intelligence that governs the world.
Yeah, an outbreak into our awareness. It's the orchestrating intelligence made visible. Perhaps if we were more perceptive, we would recognize it in all events, not just the ones that present themselves as synchronicities.
Yes.
But at this point, at least for me, it's usually only the most obvious ones that give me that felt connection to this orchestrating intelligence.
Yeah. But it does seem that the more you pay attention, the more you see. And I don't mean that as a way to diminish it, but it's more sort of like the role of awareness and the role of our attention in general seems to play a key factor in all of this, and sort of opening our own eyes to the opportunities in front of us for, as you were saying, our personal path of love and change.
Yes. Also, there is the habits that we carry in this culture of denying and resisting the deep intelligence of the world. When we do that, then we end up living in a reality in which it seems that intelligence isn't there, and we don't have access to these synchronicities because we're like establishing ourselves in a reality in which they don't exist. We're resisting the intelligence of the world through trying to establish control over our lives and over the world. So it often for people is when their personal systems of control break down and they are cast into uncertainty. Moving to a new city, everything falls apart, relationship falls apart, I lose my job, et cetera, et cetera. Like when you don't know how to control things anymore and you kind of give up on controlling things and bow to the flow of life, that the synchronicities then emerge and give a hint about maybe how to live in a completely different way. This it's like we get torn away from the sapling by the riverbank that we've been clinging onto, and now we're in the current and we're being taken somewhere. And yeah, we still use our powers to avoid rocks and things, but really we're going where the current is taking us. And then there's another sapling to cling onto, and do we cling onto it or do we stay in the flow of life and trust where it's taking us? So we have these opportunities to choose to release into a power larger than ourselves. And it is through that choice that we have access to the synchronicities that allow us to not to achieve the impossible, but allow us to participate in the manifestation of the impossible. Impossible meaning we don't have any idea how we could possibly make that happen.
That's great. I mean, yeah. That's that sense of trust is, we could call it faith. You could call it the mystery, but this does seem to be a pretty important factor. We're kind of like dancing around through this issue of the soul's purpose and this sort of like larger soul's journey of the planet and this idea of like the purpose of being here at all. And then there is a role of trusting in some larger path or trusting in your personal path unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that too for yourself or as part of this process, like that spiritual dimension? So far, it's been somewhat practical. You know, we're talking about like the earth literally and the changes mm-hmm. on the earth and what we need to like live in these bodies on this planet, but and how it makes us feel bad on the inside. It's sort of a spiritual dimension of like loss mm-hmm. and pain. But above all that, I mean, do you have much to say about just sort of the purpose of this whole journey we're even on?
Like from a personal spiritual perspective?
Or an intellectual spiritual perspective. I mean, just sort of like what role that plays in it, sort of like the soul's journey. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, some people look at it like this is a school, you know, and everyone graduates, but we're here to learn. That this whole process is a greater process of working through conflict to learn. Without conflict, without challenge, without friction, there is no learning.
Yeah.
So sort of like that's sort of the grist for the mill.
Yeah, I don't usually think in terms of we are here to learn. But it really depends on what you mean by learn, you know. I think for me, it might be more accurate to say we are here to discover new dimensions of being. That there are so many life experiences life arcs that are available to be lived in the kind of civilization that we have, and that each one of those arcs needs to be lived for this phase of civilization to be fulfilled. Mm. So the soul is cast into, or perhaps chooses, one of these arcs in order to fulfill that soul's development, to give the opportunity to that soul to have that experience which unlocks capacities that are ready to be expressed by that soul. I mean, I don't usually like go really metaphysical like this, but
I love it.
You could say that each soul carries within it many seeds that have not yet germinated, and so it seeks out a life situation that will allow that particular seed to germinate and perhaps even to flower and bear fruit, and that germination process, the expression of gifts and a contribution to a collective healing, comes in response to conditions that may not be much fun, conditions that can be traumatic, but and experiences of a great need in the world. That's what calls forth the unfolding. So in a way, you could say that all of the horror and trauma on this planet is necessary to bring the fulfillment of what we carry within us individually and collectively. That everything that you can imagine that human beings can do to each other has to be done. And that the injustice that is everywhere. I mean, I can't avoid reading about it. You know, the cops that broke into the wrong house to arrest somebody and, you know, just mistaken identity, and there they are with a gun to the dad's head while his 3-year-old and 5-year-old are begging the police not to shoot him. Like that kind of thing, which I know is not an isolated incident, but in various forms around the world.
Yeah.
You know, organ harvesting from children in Guatemala, you know, like, I mean, just this overwhelming darkness and the seeming reward that you get for participating in its perpetuation and the disincentive that you get for enacting love from the system. Like, this is all necessary too. Sometimes it does seem that the world is in the grips of evil powers, but that is what gives us something to work against, to develop the muscles of love, which we would not be able to develop if we lived in an Edenic paradise.
So it's like a very brave souls, brave world.
Do you
avoid the metaphysical aspect of it because you feel it diminishes the discussion? Or it's a trigger?
I don't avoid it. I just rarely go there.
Mm.
But sometimes it's fun to do it, and sometimes the situation calls for it to speak in that particular language. It's that a lot of what I talk about, I don't need that language to convey it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's a useful language, and it's one I'm competent in.
Yeah, a lot of these discussions, you know, there's so many buzzwords and trigger words these days anyway, and you're wading into a lot of those waters where the way you use the words is a really important way to discuss these things, as to keep people engaged. Mm-hmm. You know, words go through their own popularity and fancy of how they can pull people in or push people out just because of the baggage now they hold.
Yeah.
And I do notice that you're good with that. Like, you're good with sort of trying to make a very inclusive conversation that's a little bit hard to argue with, because there's not a theme in there that I'm like, oh, well, you know, he's talking about that such and such thing, or he's talking about the.
Well, I do try to phrase things in a way that can't be easily and mistakenly categorized.
Yeah.
As, oh, he's one of them. Oh, he's saying this. Oh, I've heard that before.
Yes.
I try to articulate things in a way that is, that signals that this is a, maybe an original idea or an unfamiliar view. So that, I have developed some skill in that.
Yeah. Do you feel like that played a role in, like, even when you were talking to Oprah, like her like resonance with it was that it felt like a singular line of.
I tried, you know, the downside of doing that is that if you do not fit into a recognizable position, then people don't always know what to do with it.
And
so they'll kind of put that in its own little cordoned off area of, well, that was interesting, or but if you are engaged in a battle, you're going to want to gather to you the voices that are your allies in that battle. And or if you're trying to establish your intellectual and social identity, you will gather people who help you do that and who affirm that identity. So if I'm saying something that doesn't fit into the established identities that people like Oprah in the mainstream have, then I'm not actually useful to them. So, you know, I feel like Oprah definitely was, she's a very perceptive, intelligent person.
She read your book, right? I mean, she personally decided she wanted to talk to
you. And so she did take it in and absorb it, I think, to some extent. But I don't think she really knows what to do with it.
Hmm.
Because it's so distant from the debates and battles that she's involved in.
What would you have wanted her to grok or do with it? What would have been a miracle solution in that end?
I mean, I trust her. I trust her and everybody to take what is useful to the proximate stage of their evolution. So I don't know. I mean, I can't know for her.
I know
what she should do. Yeah, yeah. But I would very much like. I would very much like for her to use her powers and influence to. Help change the conditions that of the polarization of our country.
I think so. Would that be to like give voice to maybe, let's say, the quote unquote other side? That's like to give more.
I wanted to do. I would like her to do peace work.
Yeah.
In a broad sense, mm-hmm. I think she's already doing that. She has that meaning.
Yeah.
If I could have a conversation with her, not a televised conversation, but a conversation with her, I would like to explore with her how she can take her next step into being a peace worker, because she has that tendency already. She has that desire, and I think she has maybe some conceptual limitations that are in the way of that next step. But I don't know.
There's a lot of, you know, the bigger, the more mainstream the media, the more they're beholden to some pretty serious corporate interests and advertisements and stuff. And it's a difficult medium to like really, I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to sell stuff and keep viewers' attention. But she stepped outside of that a little bit and definitely gone out on her own in the past while.
Yes.
And I mean, say what you want. Right. I want to honor her for, you know, she put you on. I thought that was great. And my parents watched that, Charles, and like, they're not that familiar with your work. And they felt like, they're like, oh, she's so good at like helping me get it. Like, he's like, he would say something and I'd be like, what does he mean? And then Oprah would summarize it. And I'd be like, oh, that's what he means. And I'm sitting there rolling my eyes a little bit, but at the same time, I was like, huh, you know, maybe this is making some little bridges for people. Yeah. Maybe this is opening up new ideas to who knows who, you know, middle America.
Yeah. I mean, she does, she has a certain genius for doing that.
She really does.
Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe in that interview, exactly what was supposed to happen happened. I don't feel any dissatisfaction. I feel grateful to her for having me on, and just like that we even kind of, that our life paths touched, you know, for that, for that 1 hour.
Your soul's crossed. It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I truly do not know if there is a next step for us. Or, and I also, like you were saying, you know, she is subject to pressures and influences, both internal and external, that are hard for us to imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you're that close to the core of power, and, you know, she's not in the core of power, but she's a step or two away, you know.
They were talking about her being a presidential candidate very seriously, like, a few months ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, when you're that close, like, you come into contact with very powerful dark forces. And they influence your choices in ways that seem incomprehensible to people on the outside who cannot see what you are dealing with. So I understand, you know, I understand that. And so I don't have any judgment about, you know, what she should be doing. But it would be interesting to explore that with her.
Yeah, I love this idea
opportunity
of her being like a peace worker. I mean, is that sort of how you see yourself, or do you, that's sort of like an energy you think is helpful for most people to bring out into the world? Is the idea of like inclusive, bringing things in versus pushing things away?
Yeah, being a peace worker means to see the world through eyes of friendship, to see other people not as enemies, to see them as full humans. So it means releasing judgment, and it means spreading the release of judgment to other people, to transmit it. That's what peace is. Because the extreme version of the extreme opposite of peace is war, which means holding people as an enemy and dehumanizing them. And a more subtle version of that is any judgment that we project onto another person that makes them less than what they really are. Mr. Rogers said something like this. He said, the greatest evil in the world is to reduce people to less than they really are.
Yeah. I want to see that new documentary about him.
I saw it. It's incredible.
Is it? I heard it's really good.
Yeah. You'll cry the whole time.
I'm so glad he was never in any scandal, but I mean...
Yeah.
There aren't many people like that left.
No.
Crushing our dreams, crushing our icons. Yeah.
Yeah. He's so important. He carried a medicine for our culture that is still even more relevant today. Yeah. You got to see that. Everybody's got to see that. Like the whole theater is crying. I mean, it's crazy.
Really?
Yeah.
I wish it got a wider release. Hopefully it'll be on Netflix or something. And then it would hit millions and millions and millions of folks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one more thing I wanted to ask you. Like, I remember you used to talk about this idea, and I've been thinking about it a lot lately. Holding an energy for people that it's sort of like something maybe you don't feel you can fully embody, or there's inside you, you have your own doubt, but you're able to hold that space for someone else.
Right.
Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And this is a really important idea, I think, because it's about worthiness and to say like, look, I can hold a reality for you in this moment as I'm talking to you with my eyes and my energy. Even if there's parts of me that says like, well, I don't deserve that. There's a voice that says, I have my problems. I don't want to be phony holy. But at the same time, it's sort of recognized like we can step into any space we want to embody. We don't need to be, we don't have to earn it. We don't have to be given it. It just is. And by doing that for someone else, it's quite a gift you're giving them.
Yeah. So we all have times where we're strong and times when we're weak. We have times when we're in the energy of love and times when we're in the energy of fear and despair. when we're in the energy of love and when we're strong, we are able to hold that for other people and invite them into that energy as well. And in the other times, we need people to do the same for us, which means that our enlightenment is a group process. And it means that you do not have to be a perfected soul and to be completely healed yourself in order to dare heal other people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is no other way, really. I mean, no one is perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the thing is to recognize that an upgrade in your ability to do that is on the horizon. An upgrade in your ability to hold the vibration of love is coming into you. This is not even anything that you earned, but it's happening to you. So, and I'm just claiming this.
Yeah.
But I want to just point your attention to the feel of truth that it has. An upgrade is happening to you in your ability to hold kindness, love, healing, peace, compassion. And the response to this upgrade is simply gratitude.
I have more I want to talk about, but that's a perfect way to end.
Yeah, I think so.
It really is. You actually are showing us my question. The answer is in the response. It's perfect.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Trevor. This was really a nice conversation and reconnection.
Yeah, it's always a joy. Well, that was the perfect ending. I knew it was the perfect ending. We made a little video clip of that, as he requested later, because I love it when I see him getting into his groove and he starts to embody what he's talking about. And that happens so wonderfully there. Thank you, Charles. Check him out, charleseisenstein.net. And check out his new book. Give it a pre-order. This music you are hearing in the background is called Grandmother's Sphere, but it is the live version from the album Live at the Old Church that was recorded live in Portland a little bit back last year, I believe, in January. So a year and a half ago. But that's Grandmother's Sphere Live from Live at the Old Church. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you for giving this podcast a review. Please do write me and let me know that you are listening. And if you have any questions or comments, info@eastforest.org. And other than that, you just keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit, but if you do, remember, do it with grace, folks. Do it with grace.
If I could let go of everything, or I could let go of right or wrong, it would get deeper and deeper. And it was amazing. unless he returns.